final case today is case number 72443, Dorothino versus UMC of Southern Nevada, and Robert Harper Odell Jr. Ready to proceed. Ms. Perry.
Yes. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes
okay.
for rebuttal. May it please the court, I'm Zoe Terry, appearing on behalf of appellant Susan Dolofino. This case arises out of an injury sustained to Ms. Dolofino's front tooth caused by anesthesiologist Dr. Odell during an emergency hysterectomy at UMC on April the 14th, 2015. There's no dispute that there was a power outage during Mrs. Dolofino's surgery and that this plunged the surgical theater into darkness. There's also no dispute that Mrs. Dolofino's tooth was damaged by Dr. Odell. There is a dispute, however, about how her tooth was damaged. Dr. Odell is now claiming that it happened as he pushed the laryngoscope down Mrs. Dolofino's throat during a difficult endotracheal intubation. However, medical records and other evidence show the injury was caused by Dr. Odell dropping an instrument on Mrs. Dolofino's mouth when the power went out. A complaint was filed by Mrs. Dolofino. Answers were filed, and there was very limited discovery. Motions for summary judgments were filed, and they were granted as motions to dismiss. So the standard of review is de novo, and all facts in the complaint must be accepted as true. So there are three main issues in this appeal: whether an expert affidavit should have been attached to appellant's complaint, whether the motions to dismiss should have been granted against UMC for all of the causes of actions against them, and also whether the informed consent by Mrs. Dolofino is relevant. So on the issue of the expert affidavit, we would submit that NRS 41A101D applies, and that there is a rebuttable presumption of medical malpractice or professional negligence, meaning a standard of care affidavit is not required. Appellant suffered injury during the course of treatment to a part of her body not directly involved in her treatment. Dr. Odell argues that her teeth are in proximity to the area where the anesthesia is administered, but this is irrelevant, as despite his later claims, she was not injured during the administering of anesthesia. The anesthesia was commenced at 5:35. The power went out at 6:53. Dr. Odell dropped an instrument on her mouth during a power outage. The UMC records reflect that the tooth was injured during the power outage. And as I stated, his later claim that the tooth was injured during the intubation when the laryngoscope accidentally hit tooth number 8 wasn't even made until he filed his motion for summary judgment. Before then, he told plaintiff, her husband, and myself that he dropped an instrument on her mouth when the power went out. What truly happened is a question of fact for the jury. The purpose of NRS 41A100 was to recognize that certain situations do not ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence. And an affidavit should not be required from a medical expert to state that a firm grip should be maintained on your instruments to avoid them falling onto a plaintiff's mouth if the lights go out. Likewise, in her claim against UMC, Mrs. Dolofino should not need a medical expert to opine that hospital should have a backup generator that will not plunge the hospital into darkness for 4 to 5 seconds during surgeries. The purpose of 41A07 was to lower costs, reduce frivolous lawsuits, and ensure that medical malpractice actions are filed in good faith, not to require every claim that just happens to involve a hospital or a doctor to require an expert affidavit. Appellant maintains that Banks versus Sunrise Hospital is exactly on point. Mr. Banks, in that case, was held... He'd underwent surgery for his rotator cuff to his shoulder, and he suffered an injury to his brain.
It was a brilliant trial. I happen to be the trial judge.
Oh. you know it better than I then. As you know, he suffered injury to his brain and it caused him to be in a persistent vegetative state. And as you know, the court held that the brain was not directly or proximately related to his shoulder, even though the brain injury was a result of issues from the anesthesiology, which was a necessary part of the surgery. Another case on point is Seisdell versus Markman, where the surgical needle was left inside the appellant's right breast during the breast lift operation. Again, the court held that it would be unreasonable to require a plaintiff to expend unnecessary effort and expense to obtain an affidavit from a medical expert when expert testimony is not necessary for the plaintiff to succeed at trial. In that case and this case, the claims are within the common knowledge of a layperson. Another case on point, Johnson versus Ekdar, where the doctor penetrated the plaintiff's spinal dorsa, colon, and ureter during a lumbar laminectomy. The court discussed the traditional res ipsa loquitur doctrine in med mal cases and said whether the event in question is one that ordinarily does not occur in the absence of negligence may be within the common knowledge of a layperson. If it's not, then testimony of an expert witness is required. Obviously, through NRS 41A100, the legislator has determined certain situations that do not ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence. And plaintiff just needs to present some evidence of one of these factual predicates, which plaintiff submits she has. Another case on point, Fiorli. Mrs. Fiorli suffered severe burns from chemo treatment. The court allowed part of her res ipsa medical mal complaint to continue. Again, originally a defendant's motion to dismiss was permitted, and the lower court said it contained not matters of common knowledge to a layperson, but instead must be established by a medical expert. But your honors disagreed?
Ms. Terry, just briefly, isn't the determination that we have to make not how necessarily this injury occurred, but where it occurred? I mean, isn't that, in terms of the res ipsa, isn't that the determination? We have to make a determination whether this tooth is in proximity to her hysterectomy, as opposed to whether the tooth was injured by a trach tube or by an instrument falling on it.
That's one of our arguments, uh-huh. But defense have said that it's related to the anesthesiology. And so that's their argument that because the tooth was...
But the anesthesiology, we have our head-shoulder analogy. Mm-hmm. So what determination do you think this court needs to make to support your position?
Whether the tooth was damaged whether the tooth was directly or proximately related to the treatment. And the treatment of the intubation had already taken place. The intubation had already taken place. And the power went out, Dr. O'Dell was stood over her with some kind of instrument, and he dropped it. That's not related. He could have dropped it quite easily on her eye or nose. It just so happened that he dropped it in her tooth. And now they're trying to argue that because it was her tooth and that some way could be related to intubation, the res ipsa argument doesn't apply. And we say it does.
Now, do you agree these, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
That these same facts could have sounded in negligence, could have been with an affidavit,
yes,
and proceeded?
Yes. Exactly, and in fact, we did argue negligence, simple negligence, against both UMC and Dr. O'Dell in our complaint, and I come on to that later on.
What happens down the line when they get an expert for summary judgment purposes that says that they have an expert testimony that says it has to do with the incubation? Aren't you going to have to get an expert? What's it called?
Intubation.
Mr. Chilton.
Well,
what's going to happen as far as procedure? You're going to then have to get an expert to say that they're wrong so that you can survive the summary judgment.
But that's, for a start, it's factual in that Dr. O'Dell is only now arguing that the tooth was damaged during intubation. And let's not forget that this was a motion to dismiss.
Right.
So we're not even supposed to, the court is not supposed to, was not supposed to consider his affidavit.
I was just looking at beyond it.
Beyond when, that?
Then that happens.
Perhaps we will. But at this stage, for the purposes of the complaint, we did not need an expert affidavit. And that's the purpose that the, that's the reason why our complaint was dismissed. And that's why we're
Where do we stand on the issue of the generator as far as that, is there an issue as to the fact that they should have had a generator? Is that still an issue?
Yes, that's part of our negligence claim against UMC, which, again, I'm about to...
But that was dismissed?
Yeah, that, again, everything was dismissed. And that's part of my other argument, which I'm coming to now, is that... The motions for summary judgment by Dr. O'Dell and UMC were treated as motions to dismiss. So the motions to the standard of review is de novo. The court must accept all factual allegations as true in plaintiff's complaint and should draw every reasonable inference in defendant in plaintiff's favor. And even if the professional negligence claims against UMC should have been dismissed, which we don't argue they should, there are other claims that don't require standard of care affidavits that should have been permitted to continue, actually against both defendants, but particularly against UMC. For example, the negligence case, the more recent case of Zimborski versus Spring Mountain Treatment Center, said that defendant's motion to dismiss that had been granted because there was no medical expert affidavit was incorrect in that various causes of actions should be allowed to continue because the court held that if the hospital was performing non-medical services, it could be liable under principles of other negligence. Here, UMC was providing power to its building. That's a non-medical service. And also the court said if the claim was not related to medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment, it can be simple negligence. Well, here, UMC had a duty to provide uninterrupted power supply to its hospital. And that's not related to medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment.
Ms. Terry, I want to back up because I'm just mindful of your time. You mentioned, because I want to talk again back about the res ipsa, the where versus how. When you were describing the trach entry, you called it treatment. Isn't the treatment that we're to be concerned with for our determination under res ipsa is what body part are you working on? So the fact that there's some tangential things that are necessary and part of it, that's not the, that when we talk about the where, that's not the treatment that we're talking about. Isn't that correct?
But he was done treating. He had finished intubating her.
But even if it... We talk about if it's a hysterectomy, for purposes of res ipsa, if another body part is injured, isn't that the issue that makes res ipsa appropriate?
Yes, and that's what I originally argued, but I'm trying to also answer their arguments in their briefs, which were, I originally argued, yes, it had nothing to do with the hysterectomy, and that's following Banks.
Great. Okay.
You have 2 minutes. You want to reserve?
I'll reserve.
And you fellas splitting the argument?
We are.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Michael Navarro, and I'm counsel for Dr. O'Dell, and we'll address the issues related to the anesthesiologist in the case. The district court got it right. This is a medical malpractice case. There was no affidavit attached with the complaint, and it is not a res ipsa case. Although the case hadn't been decided yet, the case on point here is the Peck versus Zip case, which was decided in December of 2017, where a plaintiff tried to make the argument that res ipsa applied, did not attach the expert affidavit. The court properly found it was not a res ipsa case and dismissed the case, which is exactly what happened here, and it was the appropriate decision and the correct decision in the case. This is clearly a medical malpractice case as to Dr. O'Dell. All of the alleged allegations against him took place in the operating room while he was delivering anesthesia care to the patient. there is the Szymborski standard for determining whether a case is medical negligence versus ordinary negligence. You look to whether medical treatment is involved. Ms. Terry even referenced Dr. O'Dell's care as treatment in her argument. This was treatment throughout the course of the procedure. In fact, Ms. Terry is relying on NRS 41A100, which I think is an admission that it is a medical case, that this is a medical negligence case, because you don't get 41A if it's not a medical negligence case. Clearly, 41A071 applies to this case. 41A071 requires an expert affidavit attached to a complaint. There was no expert affidavit, and 41A071 requires the district court to dismiss unless it falls within one of the exceptions.
How do you distinguish Bourne and Banks from this instance?
Because it involves an injury to the tooth,
right,
which is in proximity to the intubation procedure that Dr. O'Dell performed.
But that doesn't that necessitate that she was going in there to get intubated? I mean, it's we have cases where ureter, and I'm not a doctor, but I'm gonna go out on a limb and say the ovary and the uterus are close to the ureter. And where that was injured, they're like, hey, you're working on this part. This is not the body. This body part you injured. You're not working. That's not what you're here for. So how do we distinguish and we say, well, you're having a hysterectomy, but you injured this part. It's even farther away, I think.
So if you're looking at the cases, you cannot intubate a patient without going through the teeth. And the patient signed a consent form that said, I authorize you to intubate me for this procedure. Dr. O'Dell did not perform a hysterectomy. Now, that argument might apply to the surgeon, but the surgeon isn't named in the case. If you're going to say that an injury to the body part not involved in the treatment, Dr. O'Dell's treatment is behind the curtain. Dr. O'Dell's treatment is from the shoulder back. Dr. O'Dell's treatment was the intubation.
What injury is he treating? What's he treating?
What he's treating, he's providing her anesthetic to sedate her for the procedure that's being performed by the surgeon. Okay. But he's not the surgeon.
Okay. Well, then let's go to Banks. Let's go to shoulder and an anesthesia injury to the brain. How do you distinguish Banks from this?
The injury occurred in the brain as opposed to in the mouth where the tube had been placed for the intubation. Here, the tube had to be physically placed for the intubation. It had to go through, it had to go past the tooth into the throat. That's the distinction. The physical injury occurred during the treatment, incurred during the intubation process.
If she's precluded, perhaps, in the absence of an affidavit from pursuing negligence, why can't, if there's facts that could support it, they pursue recipsa, a separate claim? There's facts to support it, because if an instrument's dropped, that's factually, there's a factual dispute here, apparently. Why can't they pursue recipsa, even if they're precluded from, in the absence of an affidavit, pursuing the negligence?
Because it is not a recipe, because the claim under recipes is 41A100D, and that's you're limited to the language in the statute. Statute is related, it applies to an injury during the course of treatment to a part of the body not directly involved in the treatment or proximate thereto. The mechanism of injury, the way the injury occurred, is not the relevant inquiry. Their inquiry is relationship, location to proximity to treatment. Again, Dr. O'Dell performed the intubation. He didn't perform the surgery. So the injury is in the tooth, which is in the area that he was treating the patient. Whether it's some other mechanism, whatever the mechanism is, the statute actually says it's a presumption of negligence. But because the injury is located where he was performing the procedure, where he performed his intubation, recipsa doesn't apply, and they need an expert affidavit for that.
So you agree it's the where, not the how.
It is.
But your position is that the where is the treatment that the anesthesiologist, that piece of the body, that's the where, not the hysterectomy, that's the wrong where. You're saying that?
Correct. Okay. And if you're going to be literal, you could take the position then that any anesthesia in any surgery is an injury to a part of the body not directly involved in the procedure. You could make a claim against the anesthesiologist that the incision that the surgeon made is related to a part of the body not involved in the treatment. You can make an argument that a doctor taking out a gallbladder, the incision on the skin, is an injury to the part of the body not directly involved there too. That's the same position as for the intubation, because Dr. O'Dell had to go through the tooth to place the intubation. The tooth was within the area of the treatment that he was providing to the patient. NRS 41A071 is important. The purpose of the statute is to screen potential malpractice claims and keep frivolous cases from not only going to the jury, but even from being filed. I'll run through a hypothetical with strikingly similar facts to this one. Assume a patient goes to a lawyer and says, I had an injury to my tooth during an hysterectomy procedure? Do I have a case? Let's say that lawyer sends the case out to an expert review, and the expert comes back after looking at the case and says, I don't think you have a case. This is something that could happen in the absence of negligence. It's in the consent form. I don't see any evidence that the doctor did anything wrong. If they're right, that case can go forward and all the way to trial. There is nothing unique about her case that says that she should be able to get away from the expert affidavit when every other plaintiff in a medical malpractice in the state of Nevada has to file an expert affidavit.
Well, if you went to an expert and said, a doctor dropped a tool on my face and knocked my tooth out, you might get a different result.
If that's what happened. Now, there's a dispute.
Well, there's a factual dispute.
But you could still get the expert. It's an easy expert affidavit to obtain.
Easy doesn't mean you have to. The question is, do you have to?
Right, and you don't. You have to because of the language in the statute that says if the injury is in proximity to the area of treatment, you don't get the presumption of negligence. You have to have an expert for that situation.
Do you think, that's fine. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Again, based on the fact that this is an NRS 41A case, it is a case that requires an expert affidavit. The district court did the right thing in dismissing the case, Your Honor.
Thank you. On behalf of UMC.
Jeff Pitigoff on behalf of UMC. May it please the court. Just one issue to address on the res ipsa and the distinction between Banks and what we have in this case is that it should be remembered that in Banks there was an affidavit. There was an affidavit, and the affidavit included claims about the negligent care and treatment. So I just want to make sure that that's understood. As far as UMC, the claims against UMC all involve the treatment inside the operating room and all involve medical treatment. That's precisely what the statute requires. I understand what the court was asking earlier about whether or not the issue is, well, the generator goes out. But the issue really is the generator went out for a medical procedure, and that is exactly why UMC is entitled to the protection. And, you know, there's other cases around the country.
Would UMC hire a medical expert to say that it violates the standard? Would they need a standard of care expert to say you got to keep the lights on?
Yes, and the reason I say that is JCO. The standards that are cited in the complaint are very specific for what it is that the negligence against UMC. And that's all based upon regulations for hospitals, for treatment and care in the hospital setting. That's precisely, again, why the preclusion is warranted in this case. Now, if you look at the way the courts have addressed this, or in other jurisdictions such as like California and around the country, we've got issues about leaving bed rails up and down and whether or not that would be considered something that is medical or medical malpractice. And the courts have said, yes, that is medical malpractice because it's involving the treatment and care. And it's interesting because the statutes changed in 2015 to take out the words medical malpractice and actually start to use more general terms like rendering services. It's not professional services, it's rendering services. That's what the hospital was doing. They were rendering services for this particular patient like we do for all of them. So when it comes down to a question of whether or not you look at the case of, I believe, give me 2 seconds here, the Szymborski case, which I think is completely distinguishable from what counsel had mentioned. First of all, that involved a social worker. That had nothing to do, and it had to do with releasing somebody from the premises where they already had care. It had nothing to do with a medical condition, nothing to do with treatment, nothing to do with care. It was just bye. And then the person got into some issues upon the release, and the claims were against the social worker. The experts in that case were specifically related to the experts for social workers, not for medical malpractice. That's why that case doesn't apply in this instance. However, if you still look at it and you say, okay, let's look at what you need. You need whether or not it was related to a medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment. We're right back to the same argument, which is treatment. And the treatment is precisely what we had indicated earlier, and that is they're having surgery in our medical center. It goes right back to the venue. It's the operating room. If we were going to start to try, it makes it very difficult for judges and attorneys who are practicing to determine at what point you're going to start figuring out the syntax in order to make your arguments of whether or not you need an affidavit. I think that's where the trouble in this particular case is, because no matter how you look at it, at the end of the day, UMC is a treating facility, and since the statutory change of professional negligence to just to services, I think we're right in the category of why the case law needs to follow what the statutes have done. There's a little bit of a change here. As far as the allegations specifically, we have four allegations against UMC. And the allegations deal with negligence, vicarious liability, ostensible agency, and negligent hiring, supervision, and training. Well, negligence is really the only one that counsel has mentioned that UMC has an issue with respect to the generator. But all of the rest are all related to the care by Dr. Odell. Vicarious liability, it's because of Dr. Odell's treatment in the operating room. Medical malpractice, well, that's pretty clear. And then negligent hiring of UMC, which would be based upon hiring the doctors and the nurses for the care and treatment of the patient. And the same thing with respect to the negligent supervision and retention. So at the end of the day, all of those claims were properly dismissed. And we're arguing that the first claim should be dismissed as well.
Thank you.
I'd like to address the informed consent issue briefly. It's accepted that the appellant signed an informed consent regarding anesthesia and probably the surgery too. But the anesthesia consent simply listed one of the possible side effects as swelling around the mouth and injury to the teeth, dental appliances. And it's presumed that that relates to the effects of anesthesia itself, and at worst, the intubation process. I don't think anyone envisaged that related to the potential for an instrument to drop on her mouth during either a hysterectomy or the anesthesia process. So I'd simply just say that, again, this is a motion to dismiss, not motion for summary judgment. Again, everything that was in our complaint should be accepted as true, and our complaint made it very clear that this was an injury to the plaintiff's tooth, not during the intubation. So Dr. O'Dell's affidavit, so an affidavit was not required. There are numerous other causes of action against UMC that don't require an affidavit. And the negligent supervision, retention, and hiring, I'm not sure I ever said in my complaint that that related to Dr. Odell. That related to employees regarding the generator. So that doesn't need an affidavit either. Again, UMC, the allegations against UMC don't require an affidavit at all, as they were performing non-medical services in terms of providing power to their building. This was a Res Ipsa Med Mal complaint, so again, no affidavit was needed in relation to either Dr. Odell or UMC.
Thank you, Ms. Terry. Court, thanks all three counsel for their arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted. I'm going to